From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Donald Trump has ordered deployment of National Guard troops to help the Border Patrol control the U.S.-Mexico border, even as Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen warned human traffickers are taking advantage of weak U.S. immigration laws.
Before 2011, over 90% of arriving aliens were single adult males. Today, 40% are families and children. The traffickers and smugglers know that if you arrive with a family, under our current legal and court system, you have a much better chance of being released into the United States.
She said the troop deployment is aimed at buttressing border security and welcome by state officials.
They understand the administration's desire, much like their own, to control illegal entry into our country. They understand and respect our national sovereignty.
Nielsen said the troops would help with counter-narcotics missions, infrastructure construction, surveillance operations, and aerial support. But Congress must also act, she said, to strengthen existing law.
The legislative fixes have been drafted and debated. The tools are tested and ready. All that is lacking is the will to act.
Tuesday, President Donald Trump expressed alarm over a caravan of hundreds of would-be Central American asylum seekers making their way to the U.S. border. Cameroonian security forces rescued 18 hostages, including a dozen European tourists, seized Monday by suspected Anglophone separatists in the country's southwest. Government spokesman Issa Chiroma Bakari praised security forces for their safe release of the captives. A tour group, however, contested the government version, saying its Italian and Swiss tourists were allowed to go after negotiation. As they were about to depart, they said the security forces showed up and an engagement ensued. English-speaking Cameroonians seeking a separate homeland. This is VOA News. Trade tensions between the world's two biggest economies have increased following tit-for-tat tariffs on products from both the U.S. and China. President Donald Trump's top economic advisor, Larry Kudlow, said Wednesday he expects talks to resolve matters that involve the trade deficit and the handling of intellectual property.
Both sides benefit by positive solutions that lower barriers and open markets.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross also said he expects a negotiated deal. Sarah Huckabee Sanders is a White House spokesperson.
It'll be a couple months before tariffs on either side would go into effect and be implemented, and we're hopeful that China will do the right thing. Look, China created this problem, not President Trump, but we finally actually have a president who's willing to stand up and say enough is enough. We're going to stop the unfair trade practices. We're asking China to stop unfair trade practices, and we're going to work through that process over the next couple of months.
China's U.S. Ambassador Sui Tiankai said Beijing prefers negotiations, but added it takes two to tango. Russia's call for a joint investigation into the poisoning of former Russian double agent on British soil Sergei Skripal was defeated Wednesday in a meeting of the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons at The Hague. Russia has denied accusations it was behind the March 4 nerve agent attack. British investigators determined the nerve agent used was Novichok, produced in a Russian laboratory. Turkey, Russia, and Iran meeting in Ankara Wednesday pledged to speed up efforts to end the Syrian conflict and bring stability to the country, which has known nothing but war since 2011. Host President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said the primary losers as the result of fighting is the Syrian people. He said despite current difficulties, there's a road that's getting stronger by the light of success. Washington Institute for Near East policy analyst Andrew Tabler said greater Russian, Iranian, and Turkish influence means Bashar al-Assad's control will likely continue.
It seems there is no transition in Syria, as the U.S. has outlined, and also that the ceasefire and other kinds of measures are done with that in mind. So not a transition away from Assad, but instead probably ensuring he's there for the foreseeable future.
Meanwhile, a senior Trump administration official said U.S. troops will likely stay in Syria a bit longer, but President Trump has signaled he wants them withdrawn soon. Islamist militant Al-Hassan Ag Abdul Aziz Ag Mohammed Ag Mahmoud, suspected of war crimes in Mali, appeared Wednesday before the International Criminal Court to face charges in his capacity as religious police chief in Timbuktu in 2012. He's accused of destroying cultural monuments, as well as sexual enslavement of women and girls. Britain's Prince Philip is said to be in satisfactory condition after successful hip surgery. The 96-year-old husband of Queen Elizabeth was admitted to King Edward Hospital Tuesday. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte, Washington. Today is Thursday, April 5th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. An opposition leader is the new president of Sierra Leone.
Retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio, having scored the highest vote in this presidential runoff, has been duly declared by the Chief Electoral Commissioner the winner of this election.
Lahai Lawrence Lima is the National Publicity Secretary of the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party. A spokesman for the ruling APC party says the government is happy the election was generally peaceful. Burundi accuses Rwanda of holding Burundian refugees hostage. And 25 years after apartheid, South Africa tops the list of global income inequality and poverty.
I think you can have a new president like Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa. The question will be, he will be operating within which framework in terms of the economy policy?
Joseph Matunjua is the president of the Association of Mine Workers and the Construction Union of South Africa. We'll hear from some South Sudanese who have been deported from the United States. And Volkswagen says it will build an auto assembly plant in Rwanda. Those stories plus our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There has been a winner in Sierra Leone's March 31st presidential runoff election. National Electoral Commission Chair Mohamed Kanté Wednesday night declared retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio of the opposition Sierra Leone People's Party, the SLPP, the winner with 1,319,406 votes. Samura Kamara of the ruling All People's Congress Party received 1,227,171 votes. Retired Brigadier Mada Bio was immediately sworn in Wednesday night. Lahai Lawrence Lima, National Publicity Secretary of the SLPP, says the party won by presenting a good message and a trustworthy candidate in retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio. In addition, Lima said the SLPP victory was helped by the failures of the outgoing ruling APC party.
The Chief National Electoral Commissioner has finally declared the winner of the presidential runoff. And retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio, having scored the highest vote in this presidential runoff, has been duly declared by the Chief Electoral Commissioner the winner of this election.
Tell me, Mr. Lima, how did the SLPP overcome so many political parties and the incumbent party to win this election?
Well, in the first place, we have a very good message. We maintain consistent focus in the face of difficulty. We had a message, and also banking on the failings of the APC government amidst rampant corruption, poverty written on the faces of Sierra Leoneans. Our manifesto was not just a manifesto written by academics, but it's a research-based manifesto where we were able to do a group-focused discussions with the people, sounding the felt needs of the people. And so we are able to capture the very difficulties or challenging circumstances of Sierra Leoneans across the country. And when we put our manifesto together, which was launched and titled as the People's Manifesto, the message contained therein resonated with the people, especially at this moment when we are inheriting or will be inheriting government with a broken economy, poor educational system, poor health facilities, coupled with the fact that we had a very popular presidential candidate who had served the people of this country in a very critical and difficult times, and repackaging him to the people of Sierra Leone, all of this put together actually gave us the upper hand to clinch victory.
Mr. Lima, the president-elect retired Brigadier Julius Mada Bio, where is the swearing-in ceremony going to take place? At his house or where?
Well, he has actually chosen the Radisson Blue Hotel, where, of course, he has actually relocated after incidences of violence or incidences of insecurity around his premises. And he thought it wise to have a very steady frame of mind and to be able to focus on what is happening at the moment, to have some time off and then relocated to the Radisson Blue Hotel where he stays. And we'll be using the Radisson Blue Conference Hall to have the swearing-in ceremony.
Now, during the presidential campaign, the first round and then the runoff campaign, there were all kinds of allegations, some of the allegations directed at your candidate that your party was violent. Now that he has won the election, it will be up to your party now to bring all Sierra Leoneans together.
A lot of distorted facts been put before, have been put to public domain about our presidential candidate. But people understand very well and they know who retired Brigadier Julius Madabio is. They know he's a patriot, he's a national character who cares for the people across the country. And being a national character who has served in the army and has met people of different backgrounds, different environments, in that light, he has the national character.
Lahai Lawrence Lima is the National Publicity Secretary of the Opposition Civil and People's Party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. A spokesman for Civil and President Ernest Bai Koroma says the government is happy that the first round and the run of presidential elections were generally peaceful despite instances of violence. Abdullahi Berete, who is also head of media campaign for the outgoing ruling All People's Congress Party, denied the election outcome is a rejection of President Koroma's 10 years at the helm of government. But Berete says the party plans to do a post-mortem analysis after the dust is settled to determine what went wrong.
Well, the reaction has not come out yet. The reason being our presidential candidate has been holding meetings with a couple of local and international observers, as well as the hierarchy of the party. But eventually, we are very happy that as a government, the elections went on smoothly and there was peace. And in spite of pockets of incidents of violence, they didn't impact the overall outcome of the election.
I want to ask you, Mr. Berete, where do you think the ruling All People's Congress Party, where did you go wrong and how did you lose the election?
Well, it is very hard to say for now because we put up a very solid campaign. We went in, we contested against 15 other political parties. We are able to come on board into a runoff. So maybe after the dust would have settled, that is when we'll go and do a post-mortem analysis of where we went wrong and what we did right and what we should have done better. And that way we can prepare. But the good thing is at least we are in a commanding lead in the House of Parliament because we'll be discussing now how to get a Speaker of Parliament, a Deputy Speaker of Parliament, as well as the leader of a party in parliament. That way we'll be able to move on with the governance of this country. So it was too early for me to indicate where we went wrong and where we didn't. Maybe the party will have to meet and we do a post-mortem analysis, just as we did in 2002 when President Koroma contested, but he didn't win, and had to go to parliament where he served very diligently as the minority leader.
So if you're in the majority in parliament, how come you did not win the presidency?
That has been the 1 million question everybody's asking. And some people have brought in some hypotheses to indicate that it is very rare for a party to win the majority seat in parliament and yet couldn't convert the presidency. And this is where some people strongly believe, including the legal team of the party, that some overvoting took place, in particularly the strongholds of the Sierra Leone People's Party.
Could it be that the people of Sierra Leone were, they had something against your president, that perhaps the people were tired with the ruling party leading the country?
Well, I wouldn't say they tired with the president, because the president wasn't the one who contested the election. It was Dr. Samora Kamara.
But let me put it the other way. Could it be that the APC had a very poor candidate in Mr. Samora Kamara?
Well, Samora Kamara, this is the first time he has ever contested for public elections. And the fact that he could pull over 1,200,000 valid votes, according to the results announced by NEC, which means he won the elections in a way. Because by right, as a new candidate, a new face in the political arena, if the people were not so convinced about him and the party, a party that has been in governance for 10 years, I'm sure, given the devil is due, Dr. Samora Kamara has exhibited resilience and he did very well across the board.
Mr. Berete, it has been a pleasure always talking with you. And please, you have to keep in touch. We have to keep talking.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
Abdoulaye Berete, spokesman for Sierra Leone's President Ernest Bai Koroma and also head of media campaign for the ruling APC party. He was speaking with me from the capital, Freetown. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, April 5th. And please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 15 minutes past the hour. Burundi's government has accused Rwanda of holding Burundian refugees hostage and giving them military training to oust President Pierre Nkurunziza's government. The allegations come after more than 2,000 Burundian refugees were repatriated this week from Rwanda. Moses Havyarimana reports from Bujumbura.
More than 2,000 Burundian refugees have been repatriated from Rwanda this week. The move came after the 33 of the refugees were arrested by the Rwandan authority, accused of inciting fellow refugees to reject assistance from the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. In a statement from the Rwanda Foreign Affairs Ministry, a number of the refugees showed up unusual attitudes and refused to provide biometrics data or comply to public health requirements. Philippe Nzobonariba, the spokesman of the Burundi government, said that Rwanda is trying to disrupt the ongoing referendum process that is expected to be conducted next month. He says not only Rwanda hosts the 2015 coup plotters, the terrorists, and outside the country, recruiting young children in armed group, which constitutes to serious violation of the treaty and international conventions which Rwanda ratified that prohibits arming and militarily trained refugees. Though the Rwandan government wasn't able to reply to the allegations made by the Burundi authorities, the refugees who were repatriated from Rwanda are believed to be the followers of a prophet called Zebiyange Nakumana. They say that their faith prohibits them to use biometric registration. Baron Joreje Barthelemy was among the refugees repatriated from Rwanda. He says that they wanted to separate them from being together, that some were taken to join rebel groups in forests. That's why they couldn't stay there any longer. In September last year, at least 36 Burundian refugees from the same group of Zebia followers were reportedly killed by Congolese forces during a protest in South Kivu of the Kamanyola. Pierre Nkurikiye is the Burundi police spokesman.
They have been received by police at the border and identified by the police, and police will still continue to secure them during their new lives. Not only our communications, but through the testimonies, these refugees declared that young people were detained there in the objective of recruiting them and training them.
Burundi and Rwanda relations have continued to deteriorate since 2015, when the incumbent President Pierre Nkurunziza vied for another term in the office. Rwanda accused Burundi of hosting the FDLR rebel, who are said to have committed the 1994 genocide. Burundi also accuses Rwanda of sheltering May 2015 coup plotters and militarily training refugees in efforts to oust the current government. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Bujumbura.
25 years after the end of apartheid, a new report places South Africa at the top of the list of global income inequality and poverty countries. Victor Sula, lead author of the World Bank report on poverty and inequality in South Africa, says there is no country with available data where the inequality is higher than South Africa. The report not only looked at income inequality, but also wealth inequality. Joseph Matunjwa is president of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union of South Africa. He says he's not surprised by the report's findings.
You will remember that this political dispensation that we find ourselves in, which was realized in 1994 when we first have a right to vote in South Africa, of which is where we were pinning our hope that the evil of the apartheid will be addressed through the democratic means. But we find that indeed the ANC itself, they had an ideological shift on economic views, whereby they adopted the newly globalism and market fundamentalism. It was a kind of unholiness that they embraced from the Nationalist Party. Such decision, they derailed the whole agenda of transforming South Africa politically and economically. So therefore, hence, even geno-efficient studies, it shows that South Africa is the most unequal country in the world. So it doesn't come with surprise, such thing.
South Africa has a new president. What would you want to say to him because of what is in this report?
I think you can have a new president like Mr. Cyril Ramaphosa. The question will be, he will be operating within which framework in terms of the economic policies. If it will be still this free market, neoliberal kind of economic policies, I don't see him going through or even trying to address the fundamental challenges that are facing the majority of black South Africans who were in a disadvantaged position for decades.
Recently, the new president has been talking about land redistribution. Do you think that will hold the key to reducing this vast amount of income distribution in South Africa, or the difference between poor people and the rich people in South Africa?
I think the land issue is quite important and it has to be addressed. But it shouldn't be used as a political grandstanding. We do want the land. People will dispossess their land. But I think politics is not static. They embrace a free market system. They embrace neoliberal economic system. We are in a democratic capitalism system. So then they must be cautious. What do they mean by taking land without compensation? Because one, the land should produce food for the nation. Land should produce employment for the nation.
South Africa has invested heavily in, say, social programs. Do you think all these are important, or they should come with increase in wages for workers?
I think currently in South Africa, from the 1st of April, there was an increase on taxes, which were in 14%. Now they increase it into 15%, of which the poor of the poorest will be the one that will be finding very difficult to make ends meet. And based on what you just said, yes, we will have to up the salaries of the workers in order to counter all these expensive basic needs.
Joseph Matunjwa is the president of the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union of South Africa. He was speaking with me from the city of Witbank in Mpumalanga province. Volkswagen has announced it will build not only an auto assembly plant in Rwanda, but also car sharing and ride hailing systems. Part of that new launch will include developing new mobile applications for these services, which will use the new Volkswagen cars. To build these technology tools, Volkswagen hired a Rwandan firm, Osomite Lab. The lab's chief executive, Lionel Mfizi, talks to Ricky Stryak about some of the challenges, but also the hopes.
We at Osomite Lab are going to be working with Volkswagen to create three mobility applications. The first one being a community car sharing app, which works a bit similar to Zipcar, where we shall have cars parked around close to office buildings and neighborhoods, and then people will be using their mobile phones via an Android application or iOS application to book a car, ride it around the city, and then park it back where they found it, and then they'll be billed automatically from their cell phones. So that will be the first service, which will be launched in May, end of May. And then the second mobility app is a ride-hailing app. Now, this here we're trying to create access to people who suppose don't have driver's licenses or would like to call a Volkswagen car to come pick them up where they are and then take them to where they want to go. Third one will be a public car sharing concept. This is very similar to the first car sharing app, but this will be more open to the public. You can find cars parked anywhere in the city, not just close to office buildings.
What kind of hurdles do you have for payment, for example, in countries where people, you know, often credit cards are scarce? And I mean, mobile payments by mobile money is not scarce.
If we were to develop this for the West or for Europe, we would definitely opt for using credit cards or debit cards. But in Rwanda, what's more common are mobile money. Almost everyone who has a SIM card automatically has an account on a mobile money wallet. And these services, we want them to be, and we aim for them to be completely cashless, so no one will be paying using cash.
What other kind of specific hurdles do you think you're looking at in terms of developing this in Rwanda? Do you think, you know, although this is developed in an African country, will this be a model for similar for other countries on the continent?
If I could quote Thomas Schaefer, the MD of Volkswagen South Africa, one of the reasons they chose Rwanda as their pilot country to start with these mobility solutions is that we have a very tech-savvy young population, which means most of the people in Rwanda are young, and they use technology a lot. We use a lot of smartphones. We depend a lot on apps and things like that. So I would say one of the challenges we will face in Rwanda is these are new concepts. We're not used to ride-hailing. We're not used to car-sharing. So that will be something we'll have to face, and we're hoping to challenge and, win over. This is a community, finding a way to educate the concept of car-sharing to the audience here in Rwanda. But besides that, we don't think we could face any bigger challenges than that. And I believe if it's successful in Rwanda, it can be implemented in Kenya, it can be implemented in Uganda, in DRC, and like that, because most of the things that are being done here in Rwanda, most of these countries are also trying to follow up. So I believe if it can work here, it can work elsewhere as well.
That was Lionel Mfizi, Chief Executive of Asomite Lab. He was speaking to Ricky Stryer from Rwanda's capital, Kigali. More than 20 South Sudanese men who had been living in the United States were deported back to South Sudan last week. They had been charged with several criminal offenses committed in various U.S. cities. The deportees say they are facing a lot of challenges as they begin a new life in South Sudan, but authorities in Juba say the government will help take care of the young men. Mayan David Mayar reports from Juba.
31-year-old Mabura Kau traveled to the United States as a refugee at the age of 14 in 2001. He says America molded him into a different person, and now he feels like a victim of peer pressure.
I went as a regular man from South Sudan, innocent man that want a better life for himself. But America taught me to be a criminal. You know, when I was in high school, somebody told me, this is a true story, somebody told me, smoke with me. I said, I don't smoke mabango. I go to school, that's it. 2 years later, you see me smoking bango. Because America, they influenced me. You know, it's a criminal state.
Hakau is one of the 24 South Sudanese citizens deported back to their home country from the United States last Friday. Some of the men were charged with rape, taking part in violence activities and other criminal offenses. Upon their arrival at Juba International Airport, officers with the Ministry of Interior's Department of Criminal Investigation promptly arrested Akau and the 23 other deportees. Police spokesman Daniel Justin confirms the deportees are in police custody in the capital.
We have received 24 South Sudanese deported from the USA. And then with the accompanying documents, we got that they are actually charged with some criminal activities.
Justin says the police is working to connect the deportees with their relatives. He says some of the deportees have been taken already, but others are still under police custody. Hakau claims they were picked up in Hartford, beaten, and jailed for a period of between 4 months and 1 year before being deported. He claims they were handcuffed and forced to board a plane without their belongings. Despite his abrupt departure, Hakau says he has found memories of the glittering East Coast city of Hartford, Connecticut, near New York City.
I'm used to being in America, good life. When I come, I went almost crazy, you know. They tell us they're going to give us 10,000. We didn't get not even 1,000. Some of my boys stayed behind because they were scared of the situation. I'm the real Sudanese. I say I'm going back home. If that's what America wants, I'll take it back. It was embarrassing to tell local people I come from America with no money. I have nowhere to sleep, nowhere to eat. This America we're supposed to respect and send us.
That was Mayan David Mayar reporting from Juba, South Sudan. And that is it for this Thursday, April 5th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good day.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. VOA. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.